This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, I have a guest you do not know. Joe Lules has been a friend of mine for a long time. He has been part of the UFO community for many years. We were both dear friends, friends of John Mack. We'll be talking about that a little bit. And we were friends with quite a number of people, as other people in the field as well. Joe has been working with this whole issue, and we're going to ask him to begin in a moment what got him started. He is from El Paso, and he has written about something I think is quite important, which is the idea of the soul trap. And are we in one? Is that what this is actually all about? I wrote a little blurb for his new book called The Soul Trap, Exploring the Mysteries of Faith and Life with Joe Lules is Enriching and Most Worthwhile. And that is exactly correct. Joe, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley. I really appreciate it. It's so good to see you. Don't get to see you that often. But it's been 30 years since we first met at the UFO conference in Brisbane, Australia in 1996, where we first met. And we've been good friends ever since. We hit it off. I always admired your writing. And when I saw your book, Communion, on a bookstore shelf back in 1987, I was shocked because I knew who you were. I had read your books, and I thought you were a brilliant writer and a very smart man who was taking great risk to come out and write about his own abduction experience. And I knew then that somehow I needed to get involved in this. And I started the MUFON chapter in El Paso in 1993, and I started interviewing abductees with a team of psychiatrists, certified hypnotherapists, and we got tons of people coming to us for help. And a lot of that has to do with that book, Communion. It woke up the world. There are people still today who are talking about how that book impacted them and how the cover of your book impacted them. And I thank you so much for letting me use the image from the cover of your book as an image in my first chapter, which is all about you. Thank you for letting me write about your personal life, because it's crucial. That it was crucial to what I was trying to get across to my readers. And I am so blessed to be able to say that Whitley Strieber has been my friend for 30 years.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I'm blessed to say that Joe Lules has been my friend for 30 years. And I remember that conference in Sydney. No, it was in Melbourne.
Brisbane. Yeah.
Brisbane, was it? Brisbane, yeah, very fondly. And you may think, folks, that I actually don't remember it because I had the city name wrong twice. But that's okay. Okay.
You've been to more conferences than I've been to. So.
Oh, God. Yes, yeah. I have. I always enjoy them, though. I think when I get invited to one, I think, I don't want to go to another conference.
Yeah.
And then I think, oh, yes, you do, Phil.
Yeah.
And
you
I
want
do.
To be surrounded. You know, you want to be surrounded by people who know what's going on, you know?
You do need that from time to time, because I'm mostly surrounded by people who are snickering at me and making rectal probe jokes.
Exactly.
Including most of my family and friends.
Yeah, and for me, here in El Paso, which is very a backwater, the parties that you go to and the functions, there's nobody that understands anything about it. So you end up talking with the guys about football, and the girls go off to a corner and they talk about the girl stuff, but nobody's talking. And if you ever do bring up the issue of UFOs, they think you're nuts still today. You know, they don't know anything about it. It just, and there's so much available on Well, I've been watching YouTube and amazed at how much I have learned from people like Ross Coulthart, who is from Australia. He does wonderful interviews. And then the people that are running the Skywatcher program, and actually psychically bringing entities or things down from space to within an area where they can actually be videotaped. Have you been watching that?
Well, I'm kind of confused by Skywatcher, and the reason I'm confused is I know hundreds of people who can do the same thing without any special psionics or equipment or anything.
Yeah,
I know
but
a
they're not rich. They're not. Ha they don't have the high tech video cameras
Yes, they
to.
do. I'm
Oh, do they?
sorry. They certainly
Well,
do,
okay.
but
Well,
they're
my
not.
introduction has been to through Skywatchers on YouTube. I don't know the other people that do that. That do
Yeah,
that.
well, they're mostly just ordinary people, but some of them have got really good equipment and do it every night. It's the
Wow.
thing is, it's not a big deal until it gets elevated into something special with special psionics experts and all kinds of fancy equipment. Then
Yeah.
it looks like a really big deal and something hard to do.
Yeah.
Which it isn't. Melinda Leslie in Sedona takes tours out every night, and they see UFOs every night.
But
And
these people are doing it during the day.
well, that's right. They are doing it during the day. And
That's
I listen, I've got plenty of video from people who do the same thing, do it during the day.
yeah. And then
And
there's the guy in North Carolina, Chris Bledsoe, that is can call in UAPs whenever he wants to. You know, he's had
well, he can call them in sometimes. Let's be accurate here.
okay, but
He,
a
uh,
lot
I,
of high-ranking government people have witnessed it.
Jim Semivan being the person involved and who is a
Yeah.
good friend of mine, and Jim some years ago did see this happen. That's not, I'm not saying Chris isn't legitimate, but we can't overstate the case. John Martin is he in South Carolina? No, I guess he's in, well, I forget what state he's in. It's a southern state, Memphis, Tennessee or South Carolina, I believe. And he tapes them all the time
Yeah.
and sits on
Well,
his porch with
I'll
his
tell you what.
guitar, playing his guitar, and they come and he videos them.
Oh, wow.
So it's,
Cool. That's amazing.
we have to be very careful here. This is something that belongs to the people. It doesn't
Absolutely.
belong to the special
Yeah.
guys with secret government connections and
Yeah,
stuff.
no, I agree. I agree. And I'm just mentioning this as something that I just learned. You know, I didn't know about this. But let me talk a little bit about this idea of Earth being the soul trap,
Well,
because
wait a minute,
that's very important.
Joe. Joe,
Huh?
let's do this. Let's do this in order.
Okay.
Then the
I
first
didn't
thing,
know there was an order. Okay.
oh, there's an order, all right.
All
There's a
right.
whole show all written out.
Oh,
So
okay.
just
All right.
relax, and
Yeah.
I'll take care of the questions.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Now, the first thing I want to talk about, though, is something that happened many years ago at the plantation, the Medway Plantation, owned by Lawrence Rockefeller. You were there, I was
Yes.
there,
Ed Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell was there, and John was there, and
John
Anne
Hamm.
was there, and I don't recall if your wife came.
No.
No, she
No.
didn't. And someone was also with John, and I don't recall her name.
Yeah.
And Edgar was by himself.
Yes.
And we met there for the purpose of having a private discussion about the phenomenon and trading basically things that we weren't saying publicly.
Right.
And I found it a remarkable meeting. And
Yes.
I think I would like to ask you, and I will contribute some of my own thoughts, of course, your thoughts about the meeting.
I was so honored to be invited. I believe John Mack put me on the list because I have been having a lot of communication with John about his cases that he was studying and the cases I had in El Paso, and our agreement that these beings were not just aliens from other planets, that it was far more interesting that these beings seem to us to be, first of all, a very ancient phenomena, that it was not something new, and that they seem to be interdimensional more than from other planets, although other planets do get involved in some of the cases that I have. But we kept bouncing this off of each other. I mean, these guys are like more like angels or gods because of all the things that they can do. They can manipulate the material world with their minds. They can walk through walls. Their craft fly right through mountains. It'll go underwater. And I mean, it's like they do much more than what we would expect just aliens from other planets to be able to do. And also, we were both up against the duo of Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who were saying that this was something evil, that they were here to take over the planet, and that hybrid kids were part of a program to be helping the aliens take over the world at some time in the future. That kind of thinking was just abhorrent to us. So it was almost like it was you, me, John, a few others who were had to stand up to these bozos who were saying these crazy things.
Now, John later on became much more friendly with Bud Hopkins. At that time, he felt like Bud Hopkins was very wrong.
Well, Bud had attacked him. Bud and David had attacked
Yeah,
him.
I've noticed that. He attacked a lot of people, including me.
For as being like new age, whatever they call it, they had a name for people who
Yes.
thought there was anything that had to do with spirituality.
Or people who sold more books than they did. That was another problem they had with both me and John.
And, they were so into this atheistic way of thinking, and they never talked about their religious backgrounds. I never heard them
No,
mention.
because Bud did not believe in anything. He
Yes,
didn't believe in the soul.
I think David Jacobs was the same,
I
and
have
they
no
said,
idea about David, but I had discussions with Bud about this, and
and
he said that this is what we are and this is what we have.
right. So when you believe that, you run into a dead end right away with this
Yeah,
phenomenon,
like the
because this,
entire scientific community has run into,
yeah,
and they're
exactly.
now at the far edge of quantum physics and can't figure out where they are.
Exactly. Well, they're still, and this amazes me. Our top scientists are still relying on that old kind of science that relies on the scientific method. The idea, and the scientific method relies on the idea that everything is separate, that we are separate from each other, we're separate from the planet, we're separate from the labs and the rat. The rats that are running around our maze that we do experiments on, and that if everything is separate, we can study them objectively. That's the whole idea behind the scientific method. But quantum physics has shown that and this has been known for many, many years, it's probably the 30s and 40s, that there is no separation. Separation is an illusion. And in fact, we're all one, and everything is one at the subatomic level. And so objectivity doesn't work. It's a false notion, just as the scientific method is a false notion. And that's why I relied on finding information by not just doing interviews, but helping people through hypnotherapy to not just remember what happened to them when they had the missing time they were aboard the ships and all that, but also to do past life work with them so that people could learn that they were more than just their bodies.
Now, the first chapter of your book is called We Recycle Souls,
That's
based
from
on,
the first chapter of Community.
yes, I know, that's right, and from my book.
Yeah. And
And
that when
I
I
think
read
it.
that the first time, it scared the hell out of me. I remember reading that in 2 nights. It was the most frightening book you ever wrote. Much scarier than The Hunger or any of those scary novels. This one scared the hell out of me. The other ones were fun. And I remember finishing the book. I handed the book to my wife, Hilda, who is a confirmed Catholic and always will be and has been. She read the first few pages. She threw the book across the room. She said, "I'm not going to read that." It scared the hell out of her. Just the first chapter, she wouldn't read it. But that's the
I
way we
can't say that
live.
I blame her.
Yeah.
But that phrase, we recycle souls, is huge because it's, first of all, it recognizes the existence of souls.
Right.
And if you don't do that, like a lot of the people in these the government people who are seeking to capture agency in the whole field,
Yeah.
basically don't believe they have souls.
Exactly.
Therefore, they cannot do this. It's not
No.
possible.
Right.
It's exactly like trying to climb a mountain with no legs. You can't
Right.
do it without
Yeah.
and now the other word is recycle.
Yes.
Recycle souls. And you, I know, have gone into an enormous, long life journey exploring reincarnation in many different ways.
Yeah.
But you started out wanting to talk about the words, the soul trap. You
Yeah.
began that. And so now it's time to get into that. What exactly do you mean when you say the soul trap? The name of title of your book, why did you choose to call it, say, not soul freedom or soul rescue, but the soul trap?
Well, simply because the point I wanted to get across was the point that if you don't even know that you have a soul, then you're going to be stuck in this trap of the material world over and over and over and over again. And this place is not really that much fun. If you look around, there's always chaos everywhere. Look at what's happening with Russia and Ukraine. Look at Gaza and the Israelis against the Palestinians who aren't even armed. Look at the genocide and the madness that's going on. Look at our politics, and everything on planet Earth has always been chaos. And the reason that it's chaos is because we come into this world with our memories of our past lives having been erased intentionally. And so we don't realize that we've lived before. We don't realize that we have a soul, and we go around acting like we're just these flesh and blood and bone bodies that we see in the mirror. And that's dangerous. It just results in chaos and horrible things. If you know you
Could
have a
it be, Joe, could it be that there is someone in the hidden in the shadows who doesn't want us to know we have souls
I
in
think
order that
that's,
we will recycle?
yeah, I think that's right. And they're up there. These are what I would call celestial beings who, let me just go back a bit, because the idea that Earth is a soul trap is a very, very ancient one. And I found references going back into way before the time of Christ, There was a Greek philosopher that many people haven't heard of. I didn't put him in the book because I didn't want the book to be too long, but his name was Anaxagoras, a philosopher that lived just before Plato. And in fact, he died the year Plato was born. But this guy, he believed and preached panspermia, that life came from elsewhere in the universe. Can you believe this? This is back in 500 BC. He believed that there was a being that he called the Great Archon, who created the material world, and that his purpose for doing it was to imprison souls. This goes back way, way back. This is not a new idea. And he called these divine sparks that he wanted to imprison in the material world. And this idea continues through ancient Greek tradition, through Plato and people beyond. That's why Plato taught us about reincarnation. Anaxagoras taught us about that. But somehow, into the modern age, the idea of reincarnation, being trapped, souls being trapped in the material world intentionally by higher beings, that idea was done away with by early Christianity.
Well, you know, we're going to get in just a moment, get into why that is, because after all, as you will see in a moment, the idea of reincarnation was well accepted. Now it's a kind of secret. We're in denial about it. That makes us even weaker, even more vulnerable. We'll be right back. We're talking to Joe Lules. Joe's new book, The Soul Trap, one of the Barry Downing, whom we both have known for a long time, the author of The Bible and Flying Saucers, a really interesting guy, has a very interesting take on all of this, says an
Presbyterian minister.
An excellent combination of what we have learned from E.T. Contact and the history of religion in the West. The two things are so intimately connected. Now, we were talking just a moment ago about reincarnation, and it's denied by the Catholic Church, and maybe most of the modern Christian congregations. Yeah. But one of the central features of the Testament is that John the Baptist was the reincarnation of Elijah.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
According to Jesus.
It only worked for John the Baptist, but not the rest of us. I mean,
yeah, that's crazy. And in fact, you know, the ancient Hebrews believed that their patriarchs were reincarnations of previous prophets. And what I discovered, which is, I think, amazing, through my study of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I have spent countless hours poring over, and reading a book by one of the original Dead Sea Scrolls scholars who was not a Catholic priest, a man by the name of John Allegro, he deduced that that Jesus had been a member of the Essene sect living on the shores of the Dead Sea, that name Jesus was important. In the Bible, it only shows, in the Christian Bible, it just says that the angel told Mary, the Virgin Mary, that she would be having a son and his name would be Jesus. I always wondered when I was studying the Bible, why was it Jesus? Well, there was a reason. It's because in the Essene belief system, their Messiah would be the reincarnation of the patriarch Joshua, who was Moses' right-hand man. And that means that their Messiah would be born into the Essene community and be named Joshua, or as it was called back then, Yeshua. So Yeshua is the Joshua is a translation of Yeshua from the ancient Hebrew language, and then it was translated into Greek as Jesus. So Jesus, Joshua, Yeshua, same name. The reason that she was told her, the name would be Jesus, because the Essenes believed that their Messiah would be the reincarnation of the earlier Yeshua, who we know as Joshua. This is an amazing story. Okay, it tells you something that I knew, that Jesus was part of the Essene community, and his family were all parts of the Essene community. John the Baptist, his second cousin, was a member of the Essene community. That's where they, in the Bible, it says John the Baptist grew up in the wilderness. Well, yeah, Qumran in the Judean desert is the wilderness, and that's where John the Baptist and Jesus, both as children, grew up and were taught by the Essenes. This is an important fact, because in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's clear that the people who lived on the shores of the Dead Sea, the Essenes, were deathly afraid of the Pharisees who controlled the Jerusalem temple. They were so afraid, they thought their lives were at stake if they were found out. So they wrote in the Dead Sea Scrolls about themselves, never using real names, only titles, so that you can't say, oh, that's Jesus, because their Messiah was called the Teacher of Righteousness. I can't think of a better name for Jesus than the Teacher of Righteousness. So this is very important. I bring this out in the book, the connection to the Essene community, and the reason that I know for certainty that is the case is because when I did my own, when I had a past life regression done on me, I found myself there at Qumran on the shores of the Dead Sea, with the Dead Sea Scroll jars lined up neatly for me on the beach. And what took my consciousness to that spot was a crucifix that appeared right in front of my face and just took me, my consciousness with it. The crucifix disappeared, and there I was on the shores of the Dead Sea with the scroll jars. And what that left me with was the knowledge that there was a connection between the crucifixion and Jesus and the Essenes. And I had to, from that point on, I devoted my almost my whole attention to finding out what that connection was.
In light of that, let's talk a little bit more about reincarnation. Contextually, what you understand to be the mechanics of it, and how what happened to you then informs your understanding of reincarnation.
Yeah, it does. Well, when I started looking into reincarnation, it was really by accident. What happened was, I have to tell a little bit of my religious background. I was born into a Catholic family who later converted to Protestantism. We were Presbyterians for most of my teenage years. So we were, it was a Bible church. So we studied the Bible in every which way possible, except the correct way, because they didn't know, they really didn't know about the Bible. Even our minister, who had a doctor of theology degree, was just followed the party line and didn't, and even though he knew that there are no original copies of the Bible, there are no, the Bible are what we know as today's Christian Bible is just copies of copies of copies of copies of things that were written many years ago, and many different hands tainted the originals, so that today other people's ideas, not not the ideas of Jesus, got involved in putting their own ideas forth in the New Testament Gospels. So I had to find out what it really was about, what it really meant. I didn't start that until I was middle-aged, when I started that MUFON chapter in El Paso, and we started interviewing abductees, who I prefer to call experiencers. Right away, in the first, and I wasn't doing the hypnosis then, I became a certified hypnotherapist later, but we had a certified hypnotherapist who was also a professor of sociology at the community college and had been a Catholic priest in his past life, not past life, in early life, but he left the church to marry and raise a family. Great guy. Anyway, he did this one of the first regressions to try to help a woman find out about her missing time and her UFO experiences. And what happened is instead she started talking about a past life, first in France, which where she lived in the 1700s, and speaking in French. And then she went on to remember a life where she was handing out loaves of bread to a bunch of people on the side of a mountain where she called him the master, was going to speak. And she was amazed under hypnosis that every time she took out a loaf of bread to give to people, and there were thousands, that the basket never emptied. And this is a story straight out of the New Testament. And I just didn't know what to make of this, because we were there to study UFOs and abductions. And that's not where this woman's subconscious was taking us. So, but what was really strange was that you would think that the person remembering being on at the Sermon on the Mount, as it's called in the New Testament, clearly that's where she was, that she would have been a devout Christian. But when she came out of the trance and we debriefed her, it turned out that she's Jewish, and she was not a believer in Jesus as God or Savior or whatever. She was Jewish, and she did not want to admit that the master that she followed in that past life was Jesus. I mean, why would someone remember a past life that contradicted their current belief system? And that really puzzled me. How does that work? Well, what I finally found out was that this happens all the time. People who remember past lives remember things that contradict their personal beliefs in this current life. And that shows me that what they're remembering is true, because you wouldn't do that naturally. And that got me interested in reincarnation. But it wasn't because I was looking for it. It was because it just came out during our early interviews and work with experiencers back in 1993. That's a long story, I'm sorry, but that's how it happened.
Okay, well, we'll take that under advisement.
Yeah.
And when we get back, we're going to take a little break right now. We're going to be talking about someone we all think about, but don't understand. We'll be right back. We're talking to Joe Lules. His new book, The Soul Trap. Is this a soul trap? Is that where we are? Let's talk about the Watchers. Now, everyone probably listening to this show knows a little bit about the Watchers. Some of us may know a lot about the Watchers. But let me start with this question. They certainly figure very prominently in Soul Trap.
Yes.
Who are the Watchers?
That's a very good question, Whitley. The Watchers, the name the Watchers first appears in the ancient books of Enoch. And interestingly, among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are certain categories of Dead Sea Scrolls that they found. Most of the Dead Sea Scrolls are books of the Old Testament. Okay, that's the number one category. But the second category of the most number of books among the Dead Sea Scrolls are the books of Enoch. And Enoch was said to have been someone who lived in the pre-Antediluvian world, where before the Great Flood, and who was the father of Noah, and he was among the great patriarchs, the ones that were that lived for hundreds of years as per the Old Testament. And the Watchers are prominent in the books of Enoch as beings from the skies, the heavens, angelic beings who watch over the earth, whose job is to watch over the earth. That's why they're called the Watchers. They are, I call them, the rulers of the earth. And what is described in the books of Enoch is that in the long ago time, there were some Watchers who broke away from the group, and they came down to earth, and they mated with earth, with human women, to create a hybrid species that were known as the Nephilim. And so this story goes on and on. There's a lot to know about the Watchers and how and how they related to the human race. But actually, I think the Watchers are just another term for what we today call aliens, what other people, well, for example, there's so many names in a lot of the ancient texts, like the one that I talked about, where this ancient prophet, not prophet, philosopher Anaxagoras, he called these beings archons. That's the first place where I found the word archon. And in the Gnostic text, which we'll talk about later, I hope, they're called archons rather than watchers. We call them aliens. Other people call them Francis Crick, who was the co-discoverer of the double helix nature of the DNA molecule. In his book, Life Itself, 1981, he came upon the idea that there were such beings who created life, who brought life to Earth, seeded life on Earth, and he finally ended up calling them the cosmic game wardens, because he hypothesized that after seeding life on Earth, these beings from somewhere else would come by and check on their garden of life and tinker with it from time to time. So this is a Nobel laureate, Francis Crick, who termed these beings that he theorized about cosmic game wardens. Other places they're called rulers, or in the Gnostic Gospels, those Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, they're called archons. But I think we're all talking about the same thing: beings that are powerful, creators of the material world, and who rule over us and can do whatever they want with us. And some of them want to keep us trapped in the material world. There are others who want to help us to get out. And
You know, it reminds me of a moment in my own life. Years and years ago, when my brother came to the cabin a few months after the event, the communion was published, and I was showing him around and feeling very much the cock of the walk. And we went down to the little clearing where I had been taken by, from which I had been abducted. And on the way down, I heard a voice in my head, the voice of the lady on the cover of Communion, say, "Arrogance, I can do whatever I wish to you." And but it was not someone destructive, but someone who was teaching. Because what it was the fundamental beginning lesson of my whole life with the visitors. My brother and I and some other friends who were with us then immediately thereafter had an absolutely extraordinary UFO sighting in the clearing, a big UFO that came down and was no question about what it was. And I was thinking to myself about, of course, that voice. I was thinking, oh dear, you've gotten yourself into Dutch again. But, you know, they didn't pick me because I'm not going to get myself into trouble, clearly. Anyway, the next day, all the money I had in the world just disappeared from the bank. It just disappeared. I ended up with like $20 in my wallet, and that was everything I had. And the bank manager calling me saying, Mr. Streber, we've got all these bills that we've got. We can't, we're going to have to send them. We're going to have to send all the checks back because you don't have any money with us anymore. And finally, they found the money by going into tapes in some deep archive, the backup tapes the bank kept. And wow, the money came back to me. That was a lesson.
A lesson.
A lesson from a watcher.
In humility. A lesson in humility.
In humility from a watcher who does have our best interests at heart.
Yeah.
And I have trusted the visitors who are in my life ever since because of that. And I've tried hard to at least pretend to be a humble man. But let's talk a little bit more about the relationship between the tall blondes, the grays, the Nordics, and you mentioned the reptilians, which I don't think I know anything about. I've never met them, I don't believe. But anyway, let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, in my research, which, as I said, it's still ongoing. I'm still working on cases. Not many, but people come to me for help, so I try to help them. But early on, we started running into the reptilians. It was not something that people wanted to remember because they are ugly. They are hard to look at because they're so frightening. They play a part in a lot of cases, and in the research that I was doing, which was basically reading the work of Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who were the experts on this, I never heard anything about reptilians, but we were getting a lot of reptilian cases. It turns out that others were too, but they weren't writing about them. They were. It was too scary. It was too satanic, too biblical that there would be such beings. You know, I mean, reptilian sentient beings who are more powerful than we. They didn't want to talk about it. Finally, John Mack called me one day in 2003, the year before he died, and he said, "Joe," he says, "I got to write about reptilians. I want to put all of our reptilian cases together, including those of Barbara Lamb, another researcher well recognized. And the three of us are going to put all our research about reptilians together." He called it the Reptilian Project. And then we were going to write either a book or a long article, or at least start by speaking at a conference about it. And then he went off to London and he got killed over there, and he never got back to help us finish the project. But he was,
you know, I have to say, just to interrupt you, I have always wondered about that. I've researched it pretty deeply. I have even talked to some of the people who were involved directly, were there. And it seems quite clear that John died in what, in our level of reality, is an accident, a genuine, legitimate accident.
I believe
he stepped out into the street, looked the wrong way because it was late, and he'd probably had some wine and what or whatnot. And he looked the wrong way because he was in London, and the traffic goes the opposite direction. He made a classic tourist mistake.
Right.
And there was a driver racing along at the usual breakneck speed of the English and
But he
not
was
very
drunk.
sober.
He was drunk, yeah.
Drunk.
The drunk
And
driver.
Don was killed. But the Archons have a much, or the reptilians, I guess, too, and I relate the two actually, have a much more control over our lives and movements than it appears. And
Yeah.
I've always wondered if they just didn't want John around anymore.
Maybe. You know, I don't know. I have not allowed my mind to go there. I prefer to think of it as an untimely accident that was really so sad, and it left me shaken, and it left me feeling quite alone. Because we were of the same mind when it came to what this was all about. Barbara Lamb and I went ahead and spoke at the Laughlin Conference, International UFO Congress, on the subject, and we shared our cases at that time with the people there. And it's on video. It's probably on YouTube someplace, but. You know, that's just one of the types of beings that I've run into with my research. There's the mantis beings that play a prominent role, and almost like even maybe more in control than some of the others. It's very hard to know. I've run into cases where in the same place, on the same craft, you find the little grays, the tall grays, a tall blonde, a mantis being, and a reptilian. I mean, it's not, and I don't think they're all working together for the same purpose, but it's very hard to discern the relate what the relationships are between them. I
Yeah,
don't
me.
really know what.
I've had that experience too. I've encountered, or I should say, been introduced to a Nordic who proceeded to warn me that the Greys were very dangerous and we must never start a war with them,
No,
because
I wouldn't want to. No.
if we did, they would never let us win and never let us stop fighting. And now I see all this video appearing of us shooting it at their
Oh
ship.
yeah,
And I think to myself, that's really stupid.
that's stupid. Yes, we've
It's
been shooting at UFOs for forever, you know. That's our
well,
human response.
the most basic fundamental of strategy are don't shoot at what you don't know.
Right.
And that's number one. And number two is do not engage an enemy
Yeah.
unless you know
His
so,
capabilities.
no it more important than his capabilities, you need to know your own capabilities, but you also need to know
Wow.
his supply line.
Yeah.
And we don't know
No.
their
We don't.
supply line. We can't follow it back.
Yeah.
And I mean, we don't, the Native American communities who were successful in their fights against the horse soldiers
Yes.
always were successful because they were able to get back to the camps
Yeah.
that had originated, and that's why they fortified the frontier line all up and down the United States from Texas all the way to the Canadian border, because they couldn't win against the Indians unless they had those fortifications, because the
Yeah.
Indians would sneak around behind them and wreck their camps and leave them isolated out in the middle of the desert with a few
And
exhausted horses.
yeah, and at that point, the Great Plains belonged to the Indians. They knew how to
Exactly.
get around the Great Plains,
Right.
but it was like an ocean of mystery to the settlers because they didn't know how to navigate through you know waist tall grass that went on for hundreds and hundreds of miles. But the Indians knew that.
Well, let's stay with the, I'm digressing here and I'm being a bad boy. But what's new about that? Now, You know, I want to move on here a little bit. We're talking about the roles of, like, the Greys. How do you see the role of the Greys?
Well, there's the short Greys that are, I've come to think of them as more robotic. Their purpose is they do their job. They go and they get the person, put them on a ship. They take them to the, you know, put them on a little ship, take them to the big ship. They have certain functions, but it's the tall Greys that I believe are in charge of the little Greys. Nevertheless, they are powerful entities. I mean, they, like I said, they walk right through walls. They take people up through their ceilings. It's like, this is not something that an alien from another planet can do. Okay. I can't imagine that the word alien is a proper name for these beings. They're very powerful. They can do whatever. They don't seem powerful because they're so small, the little ones, but apparently they can control a human quite easily. But by putting them into some kind of a state where they can't fight back, because if the human could fight back, could quite easily probably knock the head off one of those little Greys. So they immobilize people. But they are the ones that are doing the hybrid program. But also, I think what we have to realize is that the reptilians are also doing their own hybrid program. And I have had cases where a woman who came to me for help discovered that she had half human, half reptilian children on board of a spacecraft or one of their craft. She wasn't happy with it. I mean, she was shown the child as an infant, didn't remember it. Of course, came through hypnotherapy, she was able to recover those memories. And that gets us to a point, you know, how accurate is hypnotherapy? And what I have found is hypnotherapy is extremely accurate if it's done by a professional certified hypnotherapist, which I was. And the people that we used. And also, we also had always had psychiatrists involved. And so hypnotherapy has proven to me to be accurate because I have tried and others have tried to mislead someone who's under hypnosis into a direction that we know is a false pathway. And they always push back. None of them ever follow that lead. People under hypnosis are not suggestible, as at least in the way that I do hypnosis and my team did it. Now, there are hypnotists who they do it for fun on a stage and they can get people to act like a chicken and you know all that stuff. But in those cases, the people in the audience have all volunteered to go on stage and they know they're going to be doing stupid things, okay? That's not hypnotherapy. That's just hypnosis. Hypnotherapy is the person doing the hypnosis is a therapist. And that is what I decided. When I started doing it, I knew that I couldn't just be a hypnotist, that I had to actually help people. And so in the process, I had to be sure that they were coming up with factual information. So I would always throw in a misleading question to try to get them off track. It never worked. So I think the work we did, which uncovered the different types of beings, and there's probably others that we don't know about, was accurate information.
Exactly. I agree with you there. And, you know, we're going to come to the end of the free part of the show. And I'm going to, when we get back, I want to be, to talk about the way we are bound by the archons. In other words, the material world is the soul trap. This is the soul trap. And right. How we are bound here. And can we escape after all? I think that the great promise of my life, given to me by Grays, who want us to escape, is that, yes, we can. But we're going to get into that more deeply, because there's so much confusion about who they are. The Grays are good guys, or are they bad guys? The reptilians, you think they'd always be bad guys because they're so ugly, but is that really true? And what about the mysterious presence of the tall blondes? And the Nordics, for that matter, what happened to them? We don't talk about them anymore, hardly, because they don't seem to be here anymore. So we're going to unpack all of that stuff and try to maybe at least turn on a bit of light down a road that leads out of the soul trap. Free Dreamlanders, goodbye. I love you, and I want you to stay with the show. Tell your friends about it. Subscribers will keep on keeping on. And I urge everybody to buy The Soul Trap. Get the book. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store. Get it from Amazon. But get it. It's a small book. It's not self-published, but it's published by a small publisher, because a book like this, the big publishers will never publish it. Never right. publish it. Because they're in the soul trap and they can't get out. We're talking to Joel Lewis, his book, The Soul Trap. Now let's get down deep into the nitty-gritty, Joel, because we have got about half an hour left to talk. And, you know, speaking of John Mack, something that John said, John didn't mention this to me, actually. I'll never forget when he called me up and said, Whitley, I've got the greatest UFO case in history. And I said, what is it? A school in Rhodesia where all of the children encountered beings who came in and landed. And subsequently, of course, there's been a documentary, and I watched it carefully. John was involved. One of the most important of all UFO documentaries, and the reason is simple. At one point, one of the children says that there was a warning given. The warning was, don't get too involved in technology.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely crucial. And it circles back to another warning that was deposited in 2004 in the community of Crabwood in the UK in the form of an extraordinary crop formation, which contained an image of a gray, a circle that turned out to be an ASCII code, a message, and some other images. The message was, beware the bearers of false gifts and their broken promises. There is good out there. I will tell you this from certain knowledge. Lockheed, the Defense Department, Russia, China, their defense industries, all embraced the false gifts without exception.
Yeah.
And now the study of the materials and the effort to make something out of them proceeds apace. Those are the false gifts. Not to say they will never work, but to say that when they do work, then we will find out what was false about those gifts.
Yeah.
You and I are after the good out there. That's where I'm going.
Yeah.
Where you're going. All right, so why don't the Archons want us to escape?
Well, that's a good question. I've done a lot of past life work with people. I get them in between lives where they're not material anymore. They describe themselves as just sparks of light, and that they're there with other beings that they sometimes call masters or the ones in charge, who help them to prepare for their next incarnation. And the point is that there's lessons that they need to learn in the material world before they can move on to higher levels of reality, other dimensions. And this is what the reason that they have to go back is because they have not learned everything they need to know, and they have to go back and have experiences that put them in situations where they can learn those lessons. So, for example, if someone lived a life as an owner of slaves, then that person needs to be a slave to understand what that's like, and to get rid of that bad karma. So we're back now to ancient Buddhism and Hinduism and the idea of karma, and how, what comes around goes around. And this is talked about by Jesus, taught, exactly the same thing. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. He who leadeth into captivity must be led into captivity. He who kills by the sword must be killed by the sword. This is all about the cycle of life and death, rebirth, and having to overcome bad karma that was created in prior lives. So what happens is we get ourselves trapped. We get into the physical body. We forget that we lived before. We forget that we have a soul. And we start doing things that are self-centered. Our ego overcomes us. And we start seeing ourselves as separate from everyone else. And we start doing things that are not right. And we fail to learn the lessons that we need to escape. And those lessons are learning unconditional love and learning forgiveness. Wow. Sometimes it's forgiveness of yourself, of the things that you've done. But those are the two keys to getting out of the material world, is to live a life of service to others, and not a selfish life, to get rid of the big ego, to not get embroiled in material possessions, seeking wealth and possessions. Those kinds of things are creating bad karma. It's very hard to live a righteous life and escape the material world, but you'll never do it if you don't know that's what you're supposed to do. If you don't understand that you'll have to come back and back and back again and live in this world that was created to be a world of chaos, because the chaos provides us with many opportunities to forgive others and to learn unconditional love. We're trapped.
Let me ask you this. What happens? A lot of people think that the future is very dark, that the planet is going to fail because it's overpopulated and whatnot. And, I think there's a very good case for that. I wrote a book called Superstorm with Art Bell for a reason. There is a very good case for it. What if it becomes unlivable? What if we can't live here anymore? Then what happens to us?
That's a good question. I think that my answer is, I'm not sure, but I would say that souls can be reincarnated on other planets. Okay. There's many other places that they can take souls to incarnate into material into a material world. What happens to planet Earth? Maybe it takes a long time for it to come back to where it can be livable again. But also there's the idea that these beings have been creating hybrids for years.
Yes.
I have met people at conferences who have told me that they are themselves hybrids. And these are adults. And they're walking around amongst us.
Well, you know, Joe, I have to say here, I'm very, very iffy about that. For the reason is I have met actual hybrids. And the first thing you notice about them is they are fluently telepathic. They get right into your mind, and that's how you converse with them. And they are also, they tend to be, the ones I've met tend to be autistic, and they are very disturbed people. They're not happy. And so, you know, I've had a lot of people come up to me at conferences saying they were hybrids, but they're certainly nothing like the real ones I have met.
I can't speak to that because I, you know, my only exposure to that is the ones that I have met and who have told me. And I try to honor what people believe. I mean, they are witnesses of a sort, but we have to acknowledge that there have been hybrid beings that have been produced in huge quantities over many, many years. They're out there on ships.
What do they do here?
I think that the hybrids that are being created are telepathic, are aware that they have souls, are aware of how the system works, and would be better stewards of the Earth than Homo sapiens.
Well, I'm no, not the ones I know. They are
well,
no way. They live in little impoverished enclaves, and they are very scared. They're very, very poor. They're unvoiced, and therefore they can't really function in society. And they also can't turn off the telepathy, which means that they are always hearing the voices of others in their heads.
Oh,
I've had that experience briefly a couple of times, and it is not a way to live that I would ever want.
Yeah. Well, I can only speak from what I have observed, but you asked me what will happen once we destroy Earth as a habitable planet.
If it happens, I mean,
well, there are in our galaxy, there are innumerable other habitable planets that could be used and are probably being used already. So they will find a place to reincarnate the souls. But what I was trying to get to is when I get people into past life memories and into the in-between life, they have choices about what they do, how they're going to live their next life on Earth. But they're never given the option of not reincarnating, okay? They can't say, well, you know, I'd really rather not go back down to that chaotic planet. I'd rather move on to a higher existence. They never allow that. It's always, you got to go back. And not only that, we're going to erase your memories. And if you look at it another way, if you didn't have your memories erased and you knew all about who you were and where you have been before, then and what the plan was that had been made for this life, well, you know, it's like having the answers to the test before the final exam. You have to live through those experiences and so that you can be observed when you make the proper choice or the improper choice in life. You know, people have many choices to help others or to not, to forgive or not forgive. These are choices we're given. And if we don't learn, if we don't do it right, we're coming back again.
Well, there's a very basic thing here. If we can never escape the wheel of life, this is a prison. If we can escape, it's a school. So what is it? Which is.
It could be, you can look at it either way. It is a school, that's for sure.
Then you're saying that it is possible to escape the wheel of life.
Yes, absolutely. Let me give you the example. I had an amazing experience. I write about it in my book. I was a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch for 31 years. I had a large clientele. I had a lot of referrals because I always treated my clients right. So I would get a lot of referrals. And I got a referral from one of my Jewish doctors, who was one of my clients, and he referred this other Jewish doctor to me who was retiring as an oncologist. And I was interviewing him the first time because I always want to know as much as I can about people that I was giving financial advice to, so I would know what to offer and what to tell them. And so he was telling me his life story, and I was asking him questions about how he grew up. And he still spoke with an accent because he was had been born in Poland. And I found out that I found very interesting information about him because at one point, after about 30, 45 minutes of talking, he rolled up his left sleeve and he put his arm on the table in front of me so that I could see the back of his wrist. And on the back of the wrist was a bunch of tattooed numbers, which I did not understand. And he said, "I was a prisoner in a war camp in Poland. I was liberated by the Americans, and I came to America I wanted to become a doctor." So he did. The army put him through medical school, so he was an army doctor for many years. And I was blown away. I said, "I don't know how you possibly could survive mentally after being in a concentration Jewish Nazi concentration camp for all those years." And he looked at me, he leaned forward, and he said, "I forgave them all.
Amazing. And
I
now
forgave."
you have said it. This is the key. This is the escape route. I forgave them all. I asked my wife about compassion. She is a very interesting being. She is both ascended and in life at the same time. She's living another life now, but also is an ascended being. And I asked her about compassion, because that's the key to forgiveness, of course. And she said simply, each of us is all we have. And when you see that, you say that, and you see another person before you, or yourself, this is all they have. Then they are struggling in there too, just like you. And it changes everything. It makes you suddenly aware of their helplessness and your own, and all of us on this strange night ship on the stormy sea of Earth. And let's move on a little bit. And now I want to talk about the ways of binding human beings to the material realm. Because we're living, for example, in the United States right now, in a country that is absolutely dominated by super wealthy people and the politicians who serve them. There are people riding around the oceans of this tired old planet in gigantic yachts that are made for four or five people and consume literally unimaginable amounts of fuel every hour, spewing all of the residue right out into the atmosphere. People who are so steeped in the material world that it feels to me when I'm with them, and I'm often with very wealthy people because of my life, and they're interested in what I have in my life. I can almost see the chains, and I can't say anything. And I'm always reminded of the wealthy young man who said to Jesus, I want to follow you. And Jesus said, then give up all you have. And he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So where are we with this? Are the archons winning? Because I know everyone strives for more material wealth first.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, it's easy to get caught up in the distractions. All of these things are distractions from learning about spirituality. Learning about your soul and spirituality are low on the list of things that most humans have to do on a daily basis.
Yes.
You know? And look at how, well, you know, you at one time worked in advertising,
yes,
right? And I see advertising as a great evil because it's presenting us with material things that, hey, look, you can buy this and you can buy that. And as a result, when I watch TV, I always mute the commercials. I don't want to hear what they have to say. I don't want a sales pitch, you know, but it's all of that stuff that's out there. That's a distraction. New cars, and you know, a new home, and all the things that you see, and the TV show. So many TV shows revolve around people who are wealthy, who live in beautiful homes, and they make you want to have what they have, right? So the media, just in general, are a big distraction from finding the divine spark within you, which is your connection to the divine, and which so many institutions, particularly the Christian churches, they don't want you to have that because they want you to have to go through them to get to the divine. And
right.
And that prevents, you know, if a lot of times when I do a past life regression on someone, well, you know, my minister wouldn't really want me to be doing this, or my priest wouldn't want me to be doing this. But I want to know. It takes courage to seek the divine within you. That's what the past life work connects people to the divine, because they find themselves, they find their soul. They realize that they have a soul, that they lived before, they made mistakes before, and it helps them to get to the point where they can depart the soul trap, which is the material world. It's not easy. I'm preaching about it. You know, I live in a 3,000 square foot nice home in a nice area, not a gated community, but a nice area. I have two cars, and I have enough money in the bank to support myself, my wife, hopefully for the rest of our lives. So here I am. I was a financial advisor for 30 years, more than 30 years, helping people to accumulate wealth. So I have my own burdens to carry and to overcome. But hopefully, and I don't know if this is true, but hopefully I've done enough right things to help people, to help me get past that trap, past that blockade that blocks me from going into a better life next time.
You know, Annie used to say, remember, Whitley, judge not lest ye be judged. And the first person is you. Don't
yes.
judge yourself.
Yes.
Now, I want to move on to something that you just referred to or brushed past, really, which is the demands of religion that we have an intermediary between us and higher levels in the form of the church, in whatever form it may take. And that gets me to the Cathars and the wonderful material in the book about the Cathars. I was recently in Rennes-le-Château and had the extraordinary privilege of, there's a locked graveyard, which is Madame Denonaud, the companion of Abbe Saunière, who was a very important person in this then still existing Cathar tradition in the language, in the southern France. And I think it still exists, actually. Yeah. It's just very secret. But they knew something about me, and so they let me into the graveyard so that I could put my hands on her grave, which was a very important moment in my life.
That's wonderful.
And as it happened, it was exactly at noon. So the door, the mayor of Rennes-le-Château opened the gate, unlocked the gate and opened it. And as I walked in, the bells in the church rang out. And it was a tremendously moving moment for me because you speak of past lives. This is my past world, the world of the Cathars. And a lot of us who look on the internet are returning now.
Do you think you were a Cathar?
I was a Cathar. Yes, absolutely. I know the Cathar religion like the back of my hand, and I've never studied it.
My chapter on the Cathars must have hit a bell with you.
It did. That's why I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
In my little book, there's the Cathars had something called the Book of Love, which has been hidden, but it's actually not hidden. The Book of Love is the little book called The Path that I published privately some years ago. And I'm going to republish it soon. That's one of my top drawer projects.
I wish you would.
Because people do need to see it. It's hidden in the Tarot, the Book of Love. Okay. And it is a book of, the reason it's a book of love is it shows the way to ascension and how to do it and how exactly what you need to have in your life in order to do this. And we can all do it. We're all magicians of ascension, every one of us. We're not helpless. No. But tell us a little bit more about the Cathars. It's such a good chapter in the book.
It all has to do with the idea and the belief in reincarnation. The Cathars and other sects, early Christian sects, believed in reincarnation and believed that Jesus taught reincarnation. And that was anathema to the Catholic Church. And this is in the Middle Ages, in the 1100s. And do you know how to get people to stop believing in reincarnation?
Tell me.
You kill them.
Well, that's exactly what happened to the Cathars.
Exactly. So Pope Innocent III, I love that name. He
was not innocent.
No, but that's what the name that he took. He directed a crusading army to go down into what was then called the Languedoc. It wasn't part of France at that time. What is now southern France. And he directed this army to go down there and murder all the Cathars that they could find. The problem is that you couldn't tell a Cathar from anybody else.
Right.
So they just went in and slaughtered everybody.
And the Pope said, God will find his own.
Yeah, just kill everybody and God will find his own. So they would go into a village of 10,000 people and just kill everybody. Catholic priests, even in the church, they would burn the place down. And they went through all of southern France, this army, and just murdered anyone that they suspected of this belief in reincarnation and the other things that the Cathars taught. And it was a bloody massacre that took hundreds of thousands of lives. We don't know how many. It's not well documented. That is certainly a way to get people to stop talking about reincarnation. The ones that are left, the ones that are still around, But that's what happened. And it was a terrible stain on the history of the Catholic Church that nobody talks about today. You know, I married a Catholic woman. I raised my kids Catholic because that's what you have to promise when you marry a Catholic person. And so we got married in the Catholic Church, and we raised our kids Catholics. But I never was a Catholic. I never accepted the Catholic Church. I never went to confession. I never did catechism or any of those things. I slipped through the crack. But that is the people who are Catholics today, or even Protestants, because they're inheritors of this massacre. They don't know about it. They do not know what happened in the Middle Ages when a crusading army that was had been sent to kill the Islamists in Jerusalem was redirected to southern France to kill Christians who didn't believe the same Christianity that the Catholic Church believed.
Well, they didn't believe the crucial thing, which was the intermediary.
Yes.
The Cathars had a direct relationship with higher levels of being.
That's what they taught people. You don't need a pope, you don't need the priest, you don't need the cardinals.
Yes.
You have a direct connection to the divine. It's right inside of you, and that's what they would teach people. And that was a totally anathema to the Catholic Church, because they wanted all the power, that you had to go through them to get to heaven, which is crazy, crazy belief. But that's what it's all about. And even today,
well, of course, but if you go to Rome and you see St. Peter's, you see what it's really all about. The Peter's Pence that built that cathedral and so many others, that is power over.
Yeah.
And this is not the Cathar way. The Cathar way is, yeah, you've got power over you. You've
yes.
got power over yourself. And a lot of the old Cathar teachings are very weird. I mean, I still live by the diet, which is basically vegetarian diet, but you can eat fish because of the fact that it goes deep in. I don't want to get into it here,
yeah.
but suffice to say, this is my life and my diet, and I am not a believer in a lot of the old Cathar material at all, because it's outmoded. It's part of the past.
Well,
I think that
nevertheless, they were on the right track.
They were on the right track.
Yeah,
exactly.
And let's finish the story about what the church did. After they massacred all these people, they were still afraid that there were some leftover Cathars down there. So the Inquisition was created, and they sent inquisitors down there, including the famous one, Bernard Guy, who was portrayed beautifully by F. Murray Abraham in the story, in the movie, The Name of the Rose. Okay. And I don't know if you ever saw that movie, but it's
the book too was brilliant.
Yes. So Bernard Guy and his inquisitors went down to that area. By then it was annexed into France, and they would go from village to village. They would call a meeting of all the people in the village, and they would say, take one at a time. Tell me the name of a Cathar that lives in this village. And if you don't tell me, we're going to torture you. And they went through and they got people to rat on each other and forced to... Those people were, if they gave a good answer, then they were forced to go to Mass, Catholic Mass every Sunday, to be Catholics, to go through the Catholic religion. So the Inquisition played a big part in this story after all the massacres were done, and the Inquisitors were evil, evil people who believed that they had the right to murder and torture anybody to get them on the right track of Catholicism. It's a horrible story, a horror story.
It is a horror story. And, you know, I wrote a book called Jesus, A New Vision, which is secretly a Cathar book. in the sense that it shows that the marriage feast at Cana is missing somebody, the wife. The wife was Magdalene.
Of course.
And she did go to southern France and take their children with her.
Yes.
That tradition is so old and so deeply true. But we have reached the end of our time together, Joe, and we could talk all day about this extraordinary material. And I want to thank you for Soul Trap. It's a terrific read, and it's not a huge book. I mean, he speaks in such a scholarly way, you'd think it's a thick tome, but it's not. It's very accessible and fun and well worth reading. And in particular, toward the end, the material about the Cathars is so powerful and so true. I urge everyone to go and get Soul Trap. Get it from us or get it from Amazon or wherever you buy books. Get Soul Trap. And Joe, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
Well, thank you, Whitley. It's been my honor.
Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.